Welcome to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland. This week we'll speak with Matthew Cole about a remarkable piece that he wrote alleging that some members of SEAL Team 6, the legendary special operations group that killed Osama bin Laden, committed war crimes and that command often overlooked these crimes. He spent 2 years reporting this piece, and we're going to have a really interesting talk about it. Then we'll be joined by Yale political scientist John Storr to talk about Trump, Russia, and skepticism on some parts of the left about the U.S. intelligence community. It may cross into cynicism at times. I don't have a lot of time for our usual intro, but I did want to highlight one piece by Dartmouth political scientist Brendan Nyhan that ran this week in the New York Times. Nyhan had done a study looking at 30 years of media coverage of the executive branch and Congress, and he found that when there was a surge of news stories from, say, natural disasters, or he cited the early stages of the Iraq War as an example, it's less likely that scandals will gain traction among the public. And the flip side is also true. A story is more likely to become a major scandal during a slow news period when there's not a lot of other things to talk about. According to Nyhan, this phenomenon may help Donald Trump, who's shown a keen ability for drowning out a potential scandal with a more exciting story, or a more salacious story, or a goofier story. I think that there's been some debate about whether this is a skill for him or whether he is just constantly saying crazy things and it's a lucky accident. In any event, Nyhan writes, and I quote, "The continuing reality show that Mr. Trump creates may help protect him from deep damage by any particular scandal. As in the campaign, he makes so much news every day that few stories ever generate sustained controversy. Instead, public attention lurches from one story to the next, never quite focusing on any particular controversy. He may prefer it that way." And you can file that under "We Are Doomed." And we're going to break briefly and be right back with Matthew Cole. Stay tuned.
Let me tell you how it will be. There's one for you and 19 for me. Cause I'm the tax man. Yes, I'm the tax man. Now dig this. Should 5% appear too small? Just be thankful. I don't take it all. Tax man is something else, isn't it? Cause I'm the tax man. Yes, I'm the tax man. Now dig this. If you drive a truck, I'll tax the street. And if you try to fix it, I'll tax your seat. If you get too cold, I'll tax the heat. And if you take a walk, and this is awful, I'll tax your feet. Cause I'm the tax man. He's awful. Now don't ask me what is for. If you don't want to pay, pay some more. Cause I'm the tax man. Yes, I'm the tax man. dig this. Now my advice for those who die, this is awful. Beware the pennies on your eyes. Cause I'm the tax man. Yes, I'm the tax man. And you're working for me. No one but me.
Welcome back to the show. I'm still Joshua Holland. Next week, the History Channel is launching a new drama called Six. Harvey Weinstein from Miramax is the executive producer, and they're pushing it with a lot of fanfare, a lot of brouhaha. It is supposedly a drama based on real missions conducted by SEAL Team 6, which has taken on a really kind of legendary aura, thanks in large part for having been the ones to have killed Osama bin Laden. My next guest is Matthew Cole. He's a national security reporter who had a piece this week at The Intercept that you absolutely must read. It's called The Crimes of SEAL Team 6, and you can Google the title or wander over to TheIntercept.com and find it. Matthew Cole, welcome to Politics and Reality Radio.
Thanks for having me on.
Before we dig in, let me ask you this. In the piece, you describe a team with this culture of omerta, you could call it. These guys, they don't rat out their brothers in arms. But you spoke to a lot of SEAL operators or former operators. How difficult was it to get members of this closed clandestine community to speak with you about such sensitive issues?
Well, as a general rule, it's very hard. I mean, it's a very insular, tight community. Just as a basic, you know, level. But when you're talking about something that's clandestine and often covert and classified, it goes without saying that it's even harder. And they have sort of appropriate reasons to not talk about anything they do, and they serve in a job description that is often described as the silent professional. So it's a challenge. That's generally. Specifically, though, I think over, you know, and it took 2.5 years to get this right and to get enough and to put it all together. What I did end up getting were senior members or former senior members of SEAL Team 6 and leaders who had tried but failed to fix or correct what they saw were serious problems at SEAL Team 6, specifically that they had been committing war crimes of various kinds, that there was an overall failure of leadership at the command and an overall failure of moral courage, frankly. And that became a little bit easier in the sense that they wanted to come to me. And that's how the story first evolved, was that people came to me to tell me what was going on.
Now, why don't we're going to dig into a lot of the specifics, but could you give us a kind of bird's eye view of the types of potential war crimes that you uncovered in reporting the story?
You know, the way to describe essentially what has gone wrong or what is wrong with SEAL Team 6 and when we talk about the wars after 9/11 is a excessive violence, excessive brutality, unjustified killings, and specifically to war crimes. What I mean by war crimes is largely what SEAL Team 6 operators, and let me just stop here and say that this is not most SEAL Team 6 operators. This is some SEAL Team 6 operators, and in fact, we make a point to say, and I think this is very true, that the majority of SEAL Team 6 are filled with very honorable professional men, but there is a smaller group that has persistently and consistently violated international norms, violated U.S. Military law, and in the words and in the opinion of senior people at their own command, committed war crimes extensively since 2002, largely in the category of mutilating and desecrating dead bodies. That's the bulk of it, is that is that by and large, after a gunfight or after a contact in which an enemy or a believed enemy is killed or mortally wounded, SEAL Team 6 members have gone in and hacked bodies with hatchets or used knives to skin, to pull off the skin, large sections of skin of dead militants. They have also conducted what was something that was pretty ghastly to me and I had never heard of before, a something called canoeing, which is a form of firing a bullet into the forehead of a prone person, usually dead or dying, that intentionally splits open the skull and leaving the brain matter exposed and the skull in sort of a V shape. That's a particularly gruesome and done, as one source said, basically for sport. Had become something that was being done for sport by some parts of SEAL Team 6. So we're not talking about in the, you know, to give it full context, this isn't, these aren't atrocities. I know of no atrocities in which SEAL Team 6 was torturing people who were alive. Or, you know, the reality is that SEAL Team 6 is a highly professional force, but this focused on what they did with their dead. And a lot of that had to do with what I understand to be a form of psychological warfare, which was when you are in a battle in a real war up close with hyper-violence or excessive violence with Al-Qaeda or Islamic militants and jihadists in Afghanistan, Iraq, and elsewhere, where they certainly do not abide by any kind of Geneva Convention. There was at some point a escalation and a decision by certain parts of SEAL Team 6 to fight in the same manner and to leave bodies in the same manner, to send a message to the other side, to the adversary, that that U.S. forces would also not abide by Geneva Conventions and that they were not intimidated or scared by the adversary's tactics on the battlefield. You know, the excessive violence, the criminal excessive violence and brutality, there certainly was some of that. And I think most of all, what my sources described it as and likened it as, this phenomenon, was a virus that had caught on at SEAL Team 6 and that the senior leadership at SEAL Team 6 refused to eradicate. And my story tries to get into understanding why they refused to eradicate it and what the implications and the fallout was from letting that virus spread.
Now, you talk about psychological warfare, but something that jumped out at me, you know, psychological trauma cuts both ways. And it seems that the crimes that you allege in your piece appeared to be linked or accelerated as their operational as the pace of their operations picked up. And then there was one casualty that seemed to really hit home. Tell us about Neil Fifi Roberts and how his death played into this story.
Sure. Well, in 2002, when SEAL Team 6 operator Neil Roberts died in what later became known as the Battle of Roberts Ridge, Roberts was killed after he fell out of the back of a helicopter as it was trying to land on a mountaintop in eastern Afghanistan, and was later killed by Al-Qaeda fighters who had already established a hold of the mountaintop. And in the subsequent battle to try to save him, because his teammates were not aware that he was already dead, or that they were effectively too late to come back and get him, it was discovered that Robert's body had been mutilated, that the Al-Qaeda fighters, or at least one Al-Qaeda fighter, had attempted to sever his head, and in doing so had failed, but had cut off most of it. And the team that was in the country at the time, this was the first deployment of SEAL Team 6 after 9/11. So in a literal sense, for most of the men who were in SEAL Team 6 and deployed at that time. This was their first exposure to ground war. And Robert's death, first and foremost, and then the manner in which his body was treated, secondly, was a real shock to group within the unit called Red, was then called Red Team, within SEAL Team 6. And it shook them. It shook them very hard. And psychologically, many people from SEAL Team 6 believe that the unit never quite recovered, and that in the initial months afterwards, there was sort of retribution at a tit-for-tat level. Certainly, though, the memory of Roberts and the manner in which he died lasted for more than a decade within the unit. It was sort of your, you know, in the, I hate to use cliche terms, but it was their first blood spilled. And it had some real resonance with many of them. And in fact, one of the things I don't say in the article, but is in fact the case, is that the, and this goes to your question about the trauma that cuts both ways, is that after that first deployment, there were several members of SEAL Team 6 that upon experiencing their first sustained experience in war, left the unit. And what my sources have said is that's one of the normal reactions to seeing violence, visceral violence, and even at the level of being a tier one special forces or special operations soldier.
Right.
And that struck me as significant in understanding what the various responses are to that violence. And one of the other responses to that violence and trauma is the belief that the way to defeat and overcome the violence you witness is to present the other side with more violence, with a greater level of violence. And by the way, I believe that according to my sources, that from the standpoint of battlefield tactics and winning, that is a very successful method. You know, you meet the violence with more violence, and it means victory. But it does, and this is the part that I don't believe any part of the special operations community has wrestled with, is it does have a lasting impact and fallout for those who conduct it. And in a macro sense, in a big picture sense, that's what this story is really about, is the method in which they met that violence and exceeded that violence that they experienced in the battlefield, and what the fallout was from not requiring, not holding a line both legally and morally for those who committed it.
If you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with Matthew Cole about his piece, The Crimes of SEAL Team 6. Matthew, I'm going over time with you. Do you have a few more minutes?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. I'm going to ask a kind of similar question. Sorry if it overlaps a little bit, but in, I believe it was 2007, I covered the Iraq and Afghanistan winter soldier hearings in Washington. All these young veterans, a lot of whom had served multiple tours, told their stories publicly, a lot of them for the first time. And one thing that we heard over and over and over again from these vets is that on their first tours, they dealt with very strict rules of engagement. But then as the war dragged on, as they went back for their second and their third and sometimes their fourth tours, those rules were consistently loosened and then loosened again. And this had very dire consequences for the local population. So we'd hear from soldiers, you know, at first we could only shoot somebody if they aimed a gun at ourselves or a civilian. It became at the end that if you saw a guy with a shovel, that was a legitimate target. And I got a similar sense reading your piece that there was kind of an arc of this story that they started out with extremely strict rules of engagement. Can you speak to that a little bit from the give us a sense of the arc of this story from SEAL Team 6 earliest engagements in the so-called war on terror through the latter years in Afghanistan?
Sure. I mean, I think overall your description is accurate in the sense that the overall rules of engagement changed and at different points became loosened. At other points, and my story describes a scenario where SEAL Team 6, JSOC believed that SEAL Team 6 had become too out of control in early 2009, and so they imposed stricter guidelines on special operations forces, particularly in Afghanistan, that were meant to clamp down the rules of engagement and protect civilians as best they could, and also insulate U.S. forces from accusations from the Afghan government that they were killing civilians and non-combatants. I will say that overall, I believe, and I think the evidence shows, that within the constellation of U.S. forces, organizations such as SEAL Team 6, in fact, are the most judicious and the most professional in interpreting and applying the rules of engagement. And moreover, I think if you take what SEAL Team 6 is at its core, in other words, what does it actually mean to be a SEAL first and then be accepted and into the training program and pass the training program and get into the unit? It means that on a tactical level, you are in fact the best of the best, a very elite cadre. And, you know, again, what does that mean? What that means is, in fact, you have a tactical skill and ability that allows you to discern very quickly, and I mean within seconds or less, the difference between a threat and a non-threat. And so overall, I mean, I think what the reason why this story was important is because when we talk about war crimes, or when we talk about going over moral, legal, and ethical lines, that happens in war. It happens in all wars. It's especially troubling when it happens to the most professional, the highest level, and the best trained personnel that the U.S. government has. And that's what we have here. So I think overall, I would say and argue that SEAL Team 6 is the, again, the most judicious at interpreting and following rules of engagement in trying to accomplish what they've been, a task they've been given, and doing so with the least amount of casualties and the least amount of collateral damage. I mean, I've had many SEAL Team 6 members say to me, and the difference between, the reason why we exist is because, you know, when you drop a bomb, you don't have the ability to sort out who's good and who's bad. You don't have the ability to say, this person is a legitimate target, needs to die or be taken off the battlefield, and this one isn't. And when you put SEAL Team 6 operators in a space, they're the ones who can make that decision, and more often than not, make the correct decision. That doesn't mean that after 13 consecutive years of war, 14 consecutive years of war, that the trauma and the overall effect, the great degrading effect on that force, didn't result in members of that unit violating international and domestic norms for how you treat the dead or how you treat your adversary. And so that's, you know, I don't want to make too broad a claim. The rules of engagement have expanded and changed in a lot of ways in both wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. But seen in a whole, SEAL Team 6 is your best of the best. And that's why they've, you know, they pride themselves on and name, have by their own description, refer to themselves as the president's own, because they're the most discriminating force you can put on a battlefield.
Now, any small community like this is going to have an internal culture that, you know, to some degree shapes their behaviors. And you wrote about these men being issued tomahawks. Some of them became convinced that they were kind of Native American warriors. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I think one of the most, certainly one of the most interesting facets is understanding the identity issue, the cultural identity that developed inside SEAL Team 6, and which, by the way, is actually unique. You know, the Army has their own unit called, well known as Delta, you know, commonly known as Delta Force, that is just as professional, it's just as effective. It's slightly different because it comes from a different organization, and they are their own insular culture, and they have their own cultural specifics, but one thing that they don't have that SEAL Team 6 does is this moniker identity. So that, you know, Red Team, Red Squadron are your red men, and they see themselves, many of them see themselves as Native American warriors. And that tradition existed inside that unit since it was created, well before the wars, and took on a newer meaning as they were after 9/11, as they were on the battlefield. And I think part of, you know, as I was describing earlier about the response, one response to violence is to meet violence with more violence. Well, inside SEAL Team 6, within SEAL Team 6, Red Squadron was known as the group that whose belief was harder, not smarter. That was the phrase. And what that meant was is Blue Squadron, which were the pirates, or, you know, had the Jolly Roger as their thing, they had a group for a time whose response to violence was not more violence, but something closer to an art, in which they tried to not use violence to achieve their objectives, because they were trying to be most discerning, and in that sense practice a tradecraft in which they would use violence if necessary, but they tried to avoid it where at all possible, in part because there was actually a greater psychological effect on the adversary if they were able to, for instance, get into a house in the middle of the night and grab a target without anyone else being aware that they were in and out. And so that the, you know, a family or a group of militants might wake up in the morning and find that their colleague, you know, their comrade has been snatched, was a lot more terrorizing and terrifying than having, you know, SEALs bust through the door with night vision goggles and grab a guy and flex cuff him. And so that was a way in which these identities metamorphosized. And, you know, I had multiple people who were in the unit, who were in Red, for instance, who absolutely acknowledged that it was, you know, a core part of your identity was to be a Redman, was to have the hatchet issued to you. It was a testament to your belonging to this unit.
That was a leadership issue, right? They issued them tomahawks, basically tomahawks. And one of the things that I found challenging about your piece, and you are very cautious, and you make it clear that there were failures of accountability at the top that led to a lot of the problems that you describe in this piece. So on the one hand, it's clear that individual soldiers are responsible for their own actions. That's axiomatic, and it has been since the Nuremberg tribunals, for example. You can't just say, I'm following orders. But then in the piece, I really got the sense that this was first and foremost a problem with the culture that was established by the leaders of this unit, and the unwillingness or inability to hold their troops accountable for their actions. How do you allocate blame between leadership and, you know, between command and the soldiers on the ground?
Well, it's a very fair question. It's a very good one. I think that it's there's multiple parts to the answer. First of all, of course, each SEAL Team 6 operator and individual bears personal responsibility for whatever their action and conduct is on the battlefield. They are all highly trained, highly educated in the laws of war, what they're allowed to do in the battle space. They are told, you know, you're not allowed to commit atrocities. That's the explicit message. I mean, let's not confuse that. They make that message clear at different points along the training pipe and the development stages in the SEAL teams. And so anyone who does anything that's illegal or immoral or, you know, unconscionable, that they bear responsibility without a doubt. The larger issue is that where those incidents occurred and as they occurred, the senior leaders, officer corps in particular, but to some extent, the senior enlisted leaders as well, made decisions. Some of them were intentional. Some of them, I think, came from a lack of courage to hold those individual SEAL operators to account. In other words, and when I say account, in their world, that doesn't mean being brought up on charges and court-martialed. What that means is that someone stops them and says, this is not okay. You cannot do that. It is illegal. We're going to, you know, send you back home. You're going to go through retraining, or you're going to take a, you know, 6-month timeout. There are non-judicial ways of handling it, and that would be the way in which you would do something in a high-level unit, because you're trying to say, listen, we understand that war is difficult. We know that at times it can be emotional. We're supposed to be highly professional and not let emotion come into the picture. And so we're going to try to essentially retrain you. And that, or, you know, kick you out of the unit, but we're not going to put you up on charges. And that is the way in which you send the message to everybody else, hey, don't do that, right? And when the officers and senior leaders at the command failed to do that, they sent an unmistakable message to everybody else that it was acceptable. It was allowable. Now, that doesn't mean everyone chose to do it.
Right.
But it meant for those who wanted to or were interested, they were given the implicit go-ahead. Now, as it happens, my reporting, and I've been told by sources that in certain cases and with certain officers and leaders, there was more than just a silence when things went bad. There was a subtle or implicit or sometimes explicit encouragement of not war crimes per se, but hyperviolence. That the, you know, it's in this world, euphemism and language become this really relevant and important thing that's hard to understand for anyone outside of the room. So, you know, I had a description. One source was telling me about a very senior leader at the command who, when the political spotlight from President Karzai was on Special Operations Forces in Afghanistan during the 2007, 2008, 2009 time frame, this commander would go in prior to a mission and give SEAL Team 6 operators a little speech, and he would say, keep it clean, boys. Let's keep it clean. And my source said, you know, for a long time, he didn't understand what that meant. What did that mean? And later, he had a discussion with the commander, and it was made explicit. What that meant was, is we've got a lot of attention on us right now. Don't let your violence or your get excessive. Don't get do anything that's going to get us in trouble. Now, implied in that, if you have to tell your force to keep it clean, that means obviously you realize and acknowledge that there are plenty of times when they're not keeping it clean. And so, you know, now that's a difficult, that is a very difficult and nuanced thing to portray when you're trying to explain how a senior leader may subtly, or to a SEAL Team 6 operator, not so subtly, say to them, hey, tonight's a night where you cannot go out and mutilate a body. Whatever you were thinking of doing, and I don't really want to hear about it afterwards, but you got to do what you got to do. Don't make it be anything that we're going to have to answer for. You know, that's the way a command gets out of control. And a lot of that, and what I've just described, a lot of that went on at SEAL Team 6 over the course of 13 or 14 years.
Matthew Cole, I want to thank you so much for taking the time, taking extra time, more than I had asked you for, to talk about this piece. I really do appreciate it.
It's my pleasure, Joshua.
Folks, check out the piece. Go to TheIntercept.com. It's titled The Crimes of SEAL Team 6. Stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break, then be right back to talk to John Storr about domestic politics.
Now it's time for our wrap-up. Let's give it everything we've got. Ready? Begin.
Artificial amateurs aren't it all amazing? Analytically, I assault, animate things. Broken barriers bounded by the bomb beat. Buildings are broken, basically I'm bombarding. Casually create catastrophes, casualties, canceling cats got their canopies collapsing. Detonate a dime a tank, daily doing dope. Demonstrations, Don Dada on the down low. Eating other editors with each and every energetic, epileptic episode, elevated etiquette. Furious, fat, fabulous, fantastic. Flurries of funk felt feeding the fanatics. Gift got great, global goods gone glorious. Getting godly in this game with the glorious. Hit 'em high, hella hype, historic, oh hey, Holocaust hymns, hear 'em holler at your homeboy. Imitators idolize, I intimidate. In an instant, I'll rise in an irate state. Juiced on my jams like Jerry Curls, jocking joints justly. It's just me writing my journals. Kindly, I'm kindling all kinds of King Kong. Karate kick type Ritz in my kingdom. Let me live a long life lyrically. Lessons is learned, lame louses just lose to my leverage. My mind makes marvelous moves, masses. Marvel and move, many mock what I've mastered. Niggas nap knowing I'm nice naturally. Knack never lack, make noise nationally. Operation opposition off, not optional. Out of sight, out of mind, widening opticals. Perfected poems, powerful punchlines. Pummeling, petty powder puffs in my primes. White quaint clothes, keep quiet as quantum. Quarrelers ain't got a quarter of what we got. Really raw raps, rising up rapidly. Riding the rushing radioactivity. Super scientifical, sound search sought. Silencing super five saps that are soft. Tails 10 times, talented, too tough. Take that, challengers, get a tune up. Universal, unique, untouched, unadulterated. The raw, uncut, verb by smart. Victorious, valid, violate vibes that are vain. Make them vanish, while I'm all well. What a wise wordsmith, just weaving up words. Weeded up on my work shift, Xerox, my X-radiation glows. Extra large, X-height letters, xylophone tones. Yellowback, yak mouth, young ones, y'all. Yesterday's lawn yard, cell I yawn. Zigzag zombie, zoom into the zenith. Zero wins and thoughts over zealous rhyme Z-Lot.
Good. Can you say it faster?
Welcome back to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm still Joshua Holland, and I'm joined now by John Storr. John is a lecturer at Yale, and he also writes for the New Haven Register, U.S. News and World Report, the Washington Monthly, and elsewhere. John, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
John has a piece at the New Haven Register this week titled "Killing Obamacare Would Kill Jobs." I want to plug it. Listeners should check it out. But it's not what I want to discuss this week, because we did Obamacare last week and we're doing it again next week. I really want to talk about Donald Trump, Russia, and the 2016 election. But first, John, let me get your thoughts about Trump's first press conference as president-elect. I've never seen anything quite like it. Your reaction?
The same. I've never seen anything like it. It was more showmanship than presidential brief. Very defensive, not what you would hope to be seeing from a guy who's about to step into the Oval Office.
There was an interesting piece on Medium by a Russian journalist who compared it with Vladimir Putin's annual press conferences, which go on for hours, and he tends to bully reporters, ignore reporters' questions, et cetera. I was troubled by the coverage of the presser afterwards. On the whole, it seemed to me that a lot of the mainstream media underplayed the degree to which it broke from kind of established norms of behavior, with Trump assembling a bunch of staff to cheer him and all of that. It was, this is the thing that I think is a consistent challenge, is how to report on Trump using conventional journalistic standards without normalizing him. This is something that we haven't seen the press calibrate that balance very well. Anyway, let me switch gears. I think that it's unfortunate that on the broad left, not the lefty left, but the broad left of center, the issue of Russian interference in the election really seems to be influenced by lingering animosity from the Democratic primaries. I've read a number of articles suggesting that Democrats are being too credulous of the CIA or blindly believing U.S. intelligence agencies. And they often say quite explicitly that the problem is that this absolves Hillary Clinton of any responsibility for her loss, and that they find that unacceptable. I have a couple problems with that. First, I think it's a bit of a straw man, and most of us who are outraged about this stuff think that the hacks that are alleged to have been carried out by the Russians are only one of several factors that led to Trump's Electoral College win, I hate to say victory. For me, the evidence strongly suggests that James Comey was the deciding factor. Great. And I also think that Clinton was a flawed candidate whose campaign made some serious errors. But the larger problem with this dynamic, as I see it, is that Clinton's done, right? She's not going to run again. And right. to the degree that all of this is a political question,
yeah.
it's about Trump. It's about Trump's yeah. lack of legitimacy rather than Clinton's supposed lack of blame. John, your thoughts on all of this?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I think, you know, this is taking your point about the broad left, and I think you and I agree that when we say the left, we're talking about really far out on the left, not left of center, even like left of that, but really left of really far left. Nobody, you and I, or any other sane person, is going to say that Hillary Clinton ran the best campaign possible. Nobody's saying that. A lot of us are, you know, now that we've had a lot of time after the election, are saying to ourselves, oh, why didn't she do this and why didn't she do that? You know, why didn't she campaign in Wisconsin? Why didn't she listen to her ground operatives more? All those things are factors. So is the James Comey's interference. That's actually turning out to be, as evidence is collected, it's turning out to be a huge game changer. Even among people like myself who tend not to believe that there is such a thing as a game changer. The evidence is getting pretty insurmountable, or close to insurmountable. But the fact is that, you know, nobody is pointing to Hillary's loss. Nobody's pointing to Russia as the only reason that she lost. That is a straw man, and it's fundamentally dishonest. Nobody's saying that. I mean, if they are saying that, they don't know any better or they have an axe to grind. Only pure partisans are pointing to Russia and saying they're the guys who made us lose. What I want, what you want, I think, and other reasonable left of center people, is to have room for the evidence, which is growing, that the Russians did play a role in this. In particular, the disinformation campaign had an effect on those who were on the margins of supporting Hillary Clinton and just needed a little nudge to support her. They were stuck between voting for her or voting for Jill Stein, right? And I think my theory is that there was just enough disinformation out there to push them to the Jill Stein camp, and therefore lost those votes in really, really tight states like Michigan, et cetera. Now, to your point about the DNC, we knew the Russians were behind it way back in June. I mean, the DNC had hired an outside security firm to look into the hack, and they came up with a conclusion, which was that yeah, there were a bunch of Russians hacking into the DNC. We didn't know how far up the chain that went. It's only right. been recently that we know that it was precisely Vladimir Putin who was directing this, and it was only recently that we knew that Putin was trying to wound Clinton so in favor of Trump. That we didn't know back in June, but we did know that the Russians were interfering in June, and we also knew way back then that WikiLeaks was complicit in this. So none of this is coming out of nowhere, and anybody who suggests that is either not paying attention, would rather not pay attention to reality, or has an axe to grind.
I agree, and I also see people calling for hard evidence of not only Russian involvement, but Vladimir Putin's order for these hacks, proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And it strikes me that this sounds good, but it's not the evidentiary standard that we usually apply to political debates, right? If we're going to drag Russian hackers into court and prosecute them, then of course that's the standard, right? But most of us, like, for example, most of us believe that Donald Trump has sexually harassed a number of women, and we hold that view based on the preponderance of evidence. He's joked about grabbing them by the you-know-what, and then a bunch of women came forward to say that he had, in fact, harassed or assaulted them in that manner. But we don't have definitive proof that would stand up in a court of law. And when it comes to intelligence, you're not going to get the raw intel anyway. They're not going to release the stuff that reveals their methods or sources. So when you look at the preponderance of evidence, and the reason I bring this up is that you're hearing a lot from this group of, you know, I think they call themselves skeptics. I would call them cynics. that we're all going off of, we're just believing the CIA. But we're not just believing the CIA. We're looking at the question holistically. And that, you know, you can look at Russian state-owned media and how it covered the race. You can look at similar campaigns to intervene in other elections in Europe that European intelligence have pegged to Russia and Vladimir Putin. And when you put all of these factors together, it seems to paint a pretty clear picture. What do you think about this question? What evidentiary standard is appropriate here? Because we should certainly be skeptical about anonymous intelligence leaks. But how high should the bar be raised? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. So I mean, first of all, we're talking about disinformation and propaganda. You know, it is of it in its very nature. It's not going to leave a footprint. You know, it's going to have influence without having any evidence of having influenced. And so what you have to do is look at what was done, and you're not going to find the evidence of effect. That's just not the way propaganda works. You have to look at intent. You have to look what actions were taken, and then you have to look at, you know, you have to look at other evidence that's not concrete. It's more circumstantial. You know, the fact that the margins were so slim in places like Michigan, you know, where just enough people voted for Jill Stein to tip the balance, you know, those people I think were probably fairly receptive to disinformation campaigns. I'm not saying all of them. I think some people were just standing on principle, but other people, you know, they were probably fairly receptive to that kind of thing, or not as critical of information as they should have been. Let's put it that way. And going back to your point about the CIA, yeah, we should all be skeptical, but we shouldn't dismiss it entirely. Let me bring up the point that Donald Trump has been and his people have been saying, which is that, oh, the intelligence agencies botched Iraq and there was no weapons of mass destruction. Well, yes, we know this. But let's also keep in mind that the Bush administration was using the information that it wanted to see in persuading the country to invade a sovereign nation. You know, the intelligence agencies were not working in a vacuum. They were serving the president, who was choosing to pick and choose whatever information suited his particular needs. So, you know, we should point the finger at the CIA, you know, George Tenet back in the Bush administration and say, bad, you did bad. But they have actually tried to do better. And we saw that in the actual brief given to President Obama and to President-elect Donald Trump. We saw how they were trying to do better by, you know, splitting the difference between how confident they were in certain parts of the information. The NSA was moderately confident, while the CIA was very confident. And that kind of diversity of opinion is supposed to send the message that, hey, we're not just all in lockstep here. We really are trying to be as self-critical as we can to provide the best information that we can.
I would note that the Bush administration was not satisfied with what it was getting from its intelligence community at first, and set up their whole, you know, their own office within DOD and really manipulated the intelligence. So it wasn't really that it's a little bit dishonest to blame the CIA when this was an ideological goal of that administration. And they, you know, basically rejected any information that contradicted their beliefs or what they wanted to do. So BuzzFeed came out with this piece this week, got lots of attention. It is a dossier by, according to the Telegraph, a ex-MI5 operative who worked during the primaries for Jeb Bush, doing opposition research. It alleges that the Russians have dirt on Trump and either could blackmail him. The BuzzFeed piece in the lead says that this is unverified and that the report contains errors. Should they have run it? What do you think?
Yeah, I think they were okay in running it. A couple of things. One is that this information was already being presented to the president and to the president-elect. And so there's a presented by the intelligence community in consensus. So that was already a news peg in my judgment. Like the president saw it, he was taking it seriously, the president-elect saw it, and he was asked to take it seriously. That's enough to be newsworthy. The other thing, too, is that, you know, there's a lot of finger-wagging among middle-of-the-road journalists, you know, talking about journalism ethics, you know, whether you should publish unsubstantiated claims, et cetera. That standard was either overlooked or ignored entirely when it came to data documents coming out of WikiLeaks. I mean,
yes.
You know, so, I mean, you know, if you're going to have a standard, let's make it universal. If we're not, you know, otherwise, let's not just have one standard for one person and another standard for another person. I think the BuzzFeed people did American journalism a service in that they took the very first step forward when other people were not willing to go that far. And now that it's been done, everybody can go from there. Too often, and I'm a part of the media as you are, and I don't mean to single anybody out here, but too often we have a kind of herd mentality, like who's going to take the first step, and who's going to be the first one out on a branch to take the first punch from the people who are most displeased with this information. BuzzFeed did it, you know, and now everybody can just point to BuzzFeed and, you know, don't blame us. It was BuzzFeed. Meanwhile, we're going to do our own reporting. So, you know, everybody's going to forget about BuzzFeed and the ethics behind it, I think, in the next month. I think it was fine for them to do that. And they should be, I think in retrospect, too, they will be praised for having the courage to do that. Even if this information turns out to be bunk, they covered all their bases. It's important. It wasn't just a smear job. The fact that it was brought to the highest levels of the federal government was a news peg enough, in my view.
Yeah, and you know, I saw conservatives calling it fake news, and that's why I stressed that at the very top of the piece. They said this is unverified.
Mm-hmm.
They said that the report contains errors. That's not what fake news is.
Right.
Fake news does not come with caveats. It does not tell you, the reader, that this stuff is not solid information. It is intended to deceive.
Yeah.
Speaking of James Comey, the DOJ Inspector General announced this week that it was conducting an investigation into his intervention in the election. There's, as you mentioned, there's a lot of evidence that it proved decisive. There's a piece up at Vox this week,
yes,
called four pieces of evidence or four charts, whatever. It shows late breakers going overwhelmingly for Comey, for Trump after Comey's second announcement, a significant shift in the polls. It is, as you say, kind of difficult to deny. And then on Friday, House members got a classified briefing that left Democrats fuming, according to The Hill. While they couldn't share the details, I have to think that what they heard was that the Trump campaign had contacts with the Russians during the election. Yes, that's speculation, but I'm also reading between the lines because
we already know that they did from reporting from the Washington Post. David Ignatius wrote about Michael Flynn, the national security advisor to President-elect Trump, being in contact with the Russian ambassador after President Obama issued sanctions against Russian ambassadors. So we already know that they've been in contact, in intimate contact.
But that's post campaign.
Well, I was about to go to the pre-election.
The question is, did they have an active involvement in the leaks or in discussing the leaks or in inviting the hacks? This kind of, whether they were directly engaged in this project to intervene in the election.
Well, that's the question I am dying to know the answer to.
I think we all are.
We are all dying to know.
That would be illegal.
Yes, well, that's right. I mean, okay, so, you know, we have a president-elect who's, first of all, unpopular. Second, on the day he takes the oath of office, will have infringed on the emoluments clause of the Constitution, which guards against conflicts of interest. And now you have something of another order, where there's a possibility, and I stress possibility, that he was in contact with a foreign power, in collaborating with a foreign power to win the presidency. I mean, we've never been in this territory. My question is maybe an interesting one, maybe a silly one. To impeach somebody, you need to show evidence of high crimes and misdemeanors, right? Violating the emoluments clause of the Constitution rise to a high crime, or is it just merely unconstitutional? I don't know the answer to that question, and I don't know even if it's a serious question, because some legal scholar may say there's a clear answer. But I think it's one worth asking. This is independent of the Russia question, obviously. But to be unconstitutional as a president, meaning violating the conflicts of interests enshrined in the Constitution, does that rise to high crimes and misdemeanors? I don't know.
Well, I mean, any way you slice it, it is the House that indicts and then the Senate tries. So, right. I hear a lot of people talking about the possibility of impeachment, but I just don't see it unless he proves to be such a liability to the Republicans,
right,
that they judge it in their best interest to jettison him. And maybe it comes to that at some point. And I think people need to remember, because I don't know about you, John, but I've been deeply depressed, probably isn't the right word, but demoralized by the election of Donald Trump. And it's easy to forget, when you look at total Republican control of government, when you look at the maximalist right-wing agenda that they're obviously trying to shove down the throats of the American people, as Republicans like to say of Obama,
right,
that at some point, it's important to keep in mind that this guy is going into office with a 45% approval rating, and that's pretty much unprecedented in modern politics. He is the least popular president-elect in the history of polling, and that should give us, progressive America, some openings to exploit in the coming years.
No, absolutely. And not only that, but we should be wrapping ourselves in the Constitution and the American flag. I mean, this is the Republican Party that has forfeited, in my view, any claim to protecting and quote-unquote restoring the Constitution. You know, they have, in getting behind this guy, Donald Trump, they have forfeited all those claims. And that's an opportunity for Democrats and progressives to take that back and speak, not just in terms of, identity politics, as we're always accused of, but speaking in terms of country and honor and patriotism. I mean, those are things that
yes.
have been taken away from progressives for years. I grew up in the 80s, patriot Ronald Reagan. No way. You just weren't going to do that. But with Donald Trump, yes, you can. And I think we should.
I agree with you. I think that the thing that will be his undoing, if he is undone, will be the widespread corruption. But I certainly do agree with you. John Storr, I believe we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me this week. I really do appreciate it.
Thanks, Josh. Glad to be here.
I'd also like to thank Matthew Cole. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall, H-O-L. You can send an email griping about the show to politicsandreality@gmail.com. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes or Podbean or SoundCloud or wherever else you can find it. I'd like to thank Crooks and Liars and Digby's Hullabaloo and Smirking Trump for letting me host the show at their joints. Of course, I'd like to thank all of you good people for tuning in this week. Have a terrific week. A dream or two to last you all through the years. And the only prize
is a heart full of tears. Going down to Lonesome Town, where the broken heart stays. Gone.